you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
I'm a person who grew up loving, like, movies changed my life. They were my respite, my getaway, my quiet place, my happy place. The notion of, like, you know, not having that terrifies me.
Writer and producer Kenya Barris.
It also scares me that, you know, the power that subsequently the streaming platforms suddenly have, their power has just overnight exponentially, you know, increased.
I'm John Horn. Hollywood is fundamentally changing in real time. And for a lot of people, that can be terrifying. There are big questions about the future of film and TV, and there are the very real struggles of tens of thousands who've been out of work for months. But could the shutdown also be an opportunity for a much-needed industry reset, a time to fix what's been broken for far too long? And will the protests against systemic racism also reach and change Hollywood? Kenya Barris says he has hope. This is Hollywood, the sequel. Welcome to our new podcast from LAist Studios. In every episode, we are asking some of the sharpest minds in the entertainment business to look at the impact this terrible year has had on their work and predict how and if it will lead to permanent change when production resumes again. Kenya Barris is perfectly positioned to look at the shifting landscape of Hollywood. He's the creator of the semi-autobiographical ABC sitcom Black-ish and its two spinoffs, Grown-ish and Mixed-ish. And after major success in network TV, he made the leap to streaming content, signing a reported $100 million deal at Netflix. His latest series is called Black AF, and it was just renewed for a second season. And then everything stopped.
We have dates, but, you know, those dates keep getting pushed, and everyone's kind of just hopeful. We're just hopeful that, you know, at one of these dates is going to stick and we're going to actually start back up for production, because there's a lot of people who work on stage and set, you know, that feeds their families. So we're hoping that it actually gets going soon.
I reached Kenya Barris at his home, and he was about to get back into his Black AF writer's room, virtually, of course. And I asked him about writing comedy at a time like this.
A lot of the stuff that I really enjoy writing is actually, you know, kind of social commentary and things that are saying things. And right now in particular, most of the stuff that I do, it's really hard because you have to look up and you have to say, I don't know how to tell this story in an honest and sincere way and not include COVID or not include Trump or not include police brutality and not include sort of just a changing landscape and just the world is turning upside down in front of us, you know, every other day. And how do you not include that? But at the same time, do you, you know, it's still escapism and entertainment. And so you want to give people something to sort of leave the world. It's a very difficult balancing act right now. And I kind of feel like we're in uncharted territory. So we're doing the best we can to sort of figure it out. And hopefully, I think there's going to be a lot of late nights, honestly, John. I think there's going to be a lot of late nights and a lot of sort of like, okay, it was a good table read, but like, let's take it back to the lab and like, let's now, how do we figure this out? I think that that's the only way that we can really do the shows and anything that we're working on justice.
If, like me, you've been working at home, you start to notice a lot of noises around the neighborhood, especially from your neighbors. And that happened when I was talking to Kenya Barris. By the way, is that your dog I'm hearing?
It's my next door neighbor. Let me go on that.
Oh, it's the next door neighbor.
Every time I try and like enjoy my life, like there's like a gardener, a helicopter.
So we had to move locations. Then we got down to the premise of Hollywood the sequel, that this current moment, as frustrating and frightening as it is, could also be an opportunity to identify what needs to change and what can change in the industry.
I feel like the biggest thing, not the biggest thing, I think the first thing, if it were me, I would say is that we need to make sure that in front of, behind, in executive levels, at, you know, corporate level, that we are creating places of business and work models that actually reflect what the world looks like. You know, I think that that's, it starts there. You know what I'm saying? I kind of feel like let's make, you know, this, you know, these be sort of like versions of the world outside of us. And I think oftentimes we look at these in these situations and we're like, this isn't the world that I know. You know what I'm saying? And I think I really applaud Marta Kaufman. She recently talked about, and she almost like was tearful in saying it, like the idea of what friends that she never, the lack of diversity on Friends, right? And I know Marta, and she's a sweet lady and she's a genius, but you know, there's no version of whatever part of New York that might be. I don't know. You know what I'm saying? Like, oh, hey, where was this cafe at? There's not even a Puerto Rican there, but you know, so I feel like the notion of like remembering that the world needs to reflect what the world actually looks like. I think that would be my first thing. I think that looking at the place that we're making people work, you know what I'm saying? The idea that we're making people work inside a situation where they need to feel comfortable. It's work. It's not, you know, it's not the club. It's not, you know, someone's backyard. It's a place that they're going to support themselves. You know what I'm saying? And so I think, you know, if someone's LGBTQ or if they're a woman or if they're Black or Latinx or Asian or whatever the case may be, I feel like people should not have to go to work and have moments that they feel uncomfortable and they're just trying to support their family. So I think we need to make sure that we're, you know, especially in entertainment, because it has such a lax model to it, sometimes we forget that this, you know, ultimately people are trying to feed their family and keep roofs over their family's head. So we need to make sure people feel comfortable in the work environment. I also feel like, you know, I think that it's time for different stories to be told. And we, you know, and I think that that is really, really, really important. I'm doing a movie on the guy who invented the television show Cops. And the notion of how that show perverted and deranged the idea of Black, of the, what the Black community looks like and the perception of policing the Black community for generations. You know what I'm saying? I feel like, and we continue to allow it to be played, like, I feel like that was something that I feel like was just unchecked. And I feel like, you know, the unchecked balance of power has to sort of now become checked. So that's my long-winded answer of like, I think we have to start shifting the world back to a little bit more of like, you know, being aware of people outside of the mainstream.
But your mention of Cops is really important because I think it gets at two things. One is the way that narratives can shape our view of the world, and specifically the way that narratives about a certain group of people can color our view of that situation. I wouldn't say just Cops. I would say like the Lethal Weapon movies, Dirty Harry, these ideas that these rogue police officers who work kind of extrajudicially, those are the heroes of those stories, not the people that they're taking advantage of. But that's the way that we start to see the world. And it gets to the bigger point that I think you're talking about is that these stories matter because they're not just entertainment, because they really affect the way that we see things, and they start to soak into our subconscious or even our consciousness in ways that we don't really understand until it's almost too late.
Right. I think that's completely right. And I want to be clear, like, I fucking love Lethal Weapon, you know what I'm saying? But I feel like I'm looking for the lane to be widened, you know what I'm saying? We were working on two-lane highways, and I feel like the notion of diversity and the notion of like, is like, you just need to have more than one example or more than one way of looking at, you know, those types of stories. I feel like if there's, you know, more, if there's five of those, if there's five different versions of Lethal Weapon, then we have five different ways to try to see. And we're not saying like, this is just the only way of, that this works or this plays. I think that it's important to let new voices, different voices be heard and let people choose and let people see that there's not just one way and one thing, one way of looking at things, becomes that, you know, we can see entertainment, you know, it's oftentimes art with a small a, but it also can be art with a big A. You know, when Ellen got on and said, I'm gay, you know, that was a huge motion forward. When Sammy Davis kissed when Sammy Davis kissed Archie Bunker, it was a moment, you know what I'm saying? Like this, you know, I just think that in some aspects, things, entertainment can really help push the conversation forward, comedy in particular. So I think that, you know, I'm not trying to get rid of any ideas and say like, this idea can't be seen, because I think that's also harmful in a way. But I think expanding the notion and expanding the forum of ideas is really important.
I'm going to read you a quote. I did something good. I made Juneteenth very famous. It's actually an important event, an important time, but nobody had ever heard of it.
That guy.
It's not you talking about what you did on Black-ish. That's Donald Trump talking about Juneteenth. But it does bring up a point. How something like Juneteenth can become something that people talk about because they hear about it on Black-ish or on Donald Glover's show Atlanta, or now I think you're working on a musical with Pharrell Williams about it, that part of what entertainment can do is not just kind of shape the way that we see the world, but teach us something that we need to be taught.
Absolutely. Like we did another episode on Black AF about Juneteenth. It was one of my favorite episodes. And you know, I got a lot of stuff for it because people were like, he already did that on Black-ish. And I was telling my publicist and my friends, it's like, I'll do it again. And I'll tell that show again. And I'll tell that episode again and again and again. And I think the reason that I, you know, push back to on that particular thing is like, you know, one, I feel like the concept of Blackness is not one series long. You know what I'm saying? It is not under understanding what it's like to be African-American at this country, or understanding the idea of first generational, you know, success, or understanding the things. I feel like it's not one episode or one series or one season long. I feel like it's something that I do feel like repetition is really important. So I think that some of the things being talked about in different ways, said in a different way, are really important, because I do think they help to teach and pull back the curtain for people who honestly didn't know and feel like they are learning and realizing the things that they were kind of ashamed to admit they actually saw on a television. They're like, this gave me the permission to say I didn't know. I think that's a really big part of it, is just giving people the permission to say, I didn't know this before that. I think it really helps. So I think that is one of the great things about entertainment. I didn't, you know, I went to go see Hamilton. And for the most part, I was like, people were like, you know, talking about the mixed casting of it, right? And then I was like, it made me dig in. And I went and I saw that Alexander Hamilton was of mixed race. And I was like, that was, you know, just, I went and learned so much just from going to see a great play. But it's just, you know, I think that's when entertainment is at its best.
Coming up, if the balance of power is shifting from the multiplex to the living room, how badly are we going to miss actually going to the movies?
I'm writing and directing the first movie I've been offered movies before. This is the first one I took on. It's a really special thing. If I can't see that movie in theaters, I would be really, 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 really bummed out.
To stream or not to stream? That is the question, or at least one of the questions.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
While he is probably best known for his TV series like Black-ish, Kenya Barris also works in film. He co-wrote the popular comedy Girls Trip, and he also has a couple of upcoming features. But who knows when or even how they're going to come out. One of the things that is important about what you do is that you work across a lot of different platforms, and you've worked in network TV, streaming, you wrote or have writing credits on a couple of upcoming movies, Coming to America, number two, and The Witches. And those are movies that have planned theatrical releases. Right now, as we're talking, Warner Brothers has postponed the release of Tenet. Mulan's going to move as well. So what do you think about platforms? I mean, you're a parent. Will you take your kids into a movie theater? How do you think that business is going to change?
I'm terrified. I don't know. I feel like if you ask me today, would I go to a movie theater? No, not today. If you tell me, in 8 weeks, and they've come up with a viable sort of protective feature that I can go see a movie and I feel that it makes sense and it's there, maybe. If you ask me in 6 months and there's a vaccine, I might move closer to it. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm a person who grew up loving, like, movies changed my life. They were my respite, my getaway, my quiet place, my happy place. Me and my second oldest daughter, like, that is our thing to do. And it became my thing with my youngest daughter. And, the notion of, not having that terrifies me. It also scares me that, the power that subsequently streaming platforms suddenly have, their power has just overnight exponentially, increased. And, I think that Ted and Cindy and Reed and those guys are people I trust and I believe in. And I think that we have good leadership. But, like, what if they leave? What if they're, I don't know the other streamers as well. The amount of sort of, you talked about, it just said this, the amount of, like, visual education that they would be in charge of is staggering. It's staggering.
I should say that's Ted Sarandos, Cindy Holland, and Reed Hastings, the three of the most senior executives at Netflix. The other thing that's amazing about Netflix, I talked probably a year ago to an independent filmmaker who made a dozen films, and then she made her first movie for Netflix. And they said more people watched this movie on Netflix than saw all of your movies combined in theaters over their complete and total runs.
I mean, it's staggering, some of those numbers. You see things where 75 million households in a 4-day period of time watch it. That's Super Bowl numbers. The monetary sort of like equivalent to that in a movie theater, is E.T. or something? I feel like it is, it's unbelievable. So I feel like it is, and it's gotten now when you have a captive audience and there's no other options, and we're seeing, are we seeing the last gasp of network television? I hope not, but we might be. I feel like, where does that leave us? So everything is brand new, and we are looking at a time, we're staring it in the face where it's on microwave speed, how quickly the world is changing in front of us.
So let's say we're a year out from this, and let's just say people aren't dying and things have resumed to some sort of normalcy. If you look back at what comes out of all of this, what would give you maybe the most satisfaction, and what would you be most pissed off about if it wasn't actually fixed?
I'm writing and directing the first movie I've been offered movies before, but this is the first one I took on. It's a really special thing. If I can't see that movie in theaters, I would be really, 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 really bummed out. If that movie could not be, because it's a movie that I want to be viewed in theaters and I think deserves to be seen in theaters. And if it can't be a year from now, I'm looking at, and I'll be happy to get it shown anywhere, but I feel like you want certain movies, you want that movie going experience. You want people to sit down, sit in a seat with popcorn in a dark room with other people, get group laugh, get group emotion, pay for a ticket, feel like they're at an event. You want that experience, and to not have that, I think, would be an amazing bummer. And to not go, see Tenet, which trailer looks like it's, Nolan has done it again, and not see, some of my favorite filmmakers' movies, to not see a Wes Anderson movie in the movie theater, I want to go on. That's one of my alone days. I'll go and see the new Wes Anderson movie. I want to go sit down and veg out for a while and do it. So that would, if a year from now, that's where we're at, I would be most really, really bummed out.
And what about other people getting a chance to tell their own stories? Do you see that happening, changing? I mean, it's such a fractional number of people who are not white men who get to call the shots.
I think that we're definitely going to see that change. I definitely think that right now, I'm even just in things I'm working on, the things that are being bought, I'm seeing that that's happening. The thing that scares me, we kind of started this talking, is that there is no date of production. So if they tell you, you know, Kenyon John's movie is, you know, slated to come out next summer, we know that in order to shoot our movie next summer, we have our movie in their theaters by next summer, we have to start shooting by August 1st. We don't know if we can shoot August 1st. We don't know if we can shoot September 1st. We don't know if we can shoot October 1st. We're seeing how the highest spikes in COVID since COVID started. You know, how do insurance companies indemnify studios and to go and do this? Like, what is the, and are we going to shoot everything socially distanced or on long lenses? And people, you know, I mean, it's a very, very, very interesting time. So it's one of the times I don't have the answers. I don't even have a pitch. I don't have a pitch. I think Tyler Perry's notion of how he was going to do it was the best in terms of
like sequestering really everybody, basically.
I think that's the best pitch I've heard. I don't know how real it is, but that's the best pitch I've heard.
Here's my last question. You talked about Friends co-creator Marta Kaufman, and she said, I didn't do enough when it came to diversity. So she's being open and being reflective, and there is some personal accountability and honesty there. But it's one thing to have people kind of questioning, you know, their decisions. It's another thing to actually hold them to some sort of test or standard. So maybe people might start waking up and realize that they can't continue as they've done in the past. But how do you actually enforce? Seems like the wrong word, but
I don't want to enforce.
I know, but I don't, how do you make sure that they're not just going to say 10 years down the line, oh, I should have done better and actually do better now?
Here's the thing. I think that's why Marta's smarter, because she would actually say that. I don't think it was her job if that's not the, and this is my true belief. If I don't think that's her job, if that's not the Friends that she wanted to tell, I don't believe it's her job to make that Friends. There's two things that could happen. People could call her on it and stop watching or say something to her that makes her feel like, if I want this show to continue to be successful, I need to sort of change it. Or the way that I would say, let's not just have Friends. Let's have other shows that, you know what I'm saying, that do have, you know, show different reflective images to America. You know, that way that Marta can tell the show she wants to do, but someone else can go do the show that they want to do. But it's so that there's not, it's the whole thing I went back into earlier in our conversation of opening up the lanes. You know what I'm saying? And I kind of feel like if you open up the lanes, it starts to make, you know, what people's creative integrity is become, you know, not feel as threatened and feel like it's, you know, they can do what they want to do, but there's other things that sort of answer the calling of that. I took a lot of shit on my show because, you know, my kids were based upon my real kids, who were, you know, their mom is biracial and, you know, I'm not, you know, super dark. And so they were like, well, I'm a colorist. And I was like, I just did this based upon my family. And if there were more shows about Black families, I wouldn't have gotten that flack that I got, because people want to see themselves reflected. And when they don't, they feel like, well, you're one of our storytellers. Why aren't you reflecting this? And I completely understand where they're coming from, but that's not necessarily fair to me as a storyteller when I'm trying to tell a story about my family. You know what I'm saying? But there's also a responsibility that I have to try and make sure that I have other shows that do reflect this and make sure. But I feel like if we give more opportunities and have different versions of people's creations put to film and to television, I think we won't have to answer Marta filling the call of I should have done more. But I think that's the way you keep the art at its purest form.
Kenya, thanks so much for sharing your time with us.
Thanks, Sharon.
In the coming weeks, we'll explore the practical questions that will have to be solved before the cameras can roll again. Here's Homeland producer Leslie Linka-Glatter.
We're like we're a petri dish, you know, on a film set. We're very close. And something like Homeland, which is a location-based show, even more so, because oftentimes you're in very crowded locations. My little, you know, two monitor video village is stuck in the toilet, like literally in the toilet. You know, if you're shooting in a small apartment in Morocco, you go wherever you can go.
The producers struggle to figure out how and where and even what kind of stories are going to be told. Our thanks to Kenya Barris and to you for listening. We hope you'll subscribe wherever you get your podcast. This episode of Hollywood the Sequel was produced by Shelley Lewis and Monica Bushman with help from Darby Maloney and Jessica Pilot. Our engineer and sound designer is Eduardo Perez. Our theme music is composed by Nicholas Bertel. Hollywood the Sequel is a production of LAIS Studios. I'm John Horn. We'll see you next time.
I'm Julia Paskin, host of Weekend Edition. Join me as I talk with NPR's Sarah McCammon about her new book, The Ex-Evangelicals, Loving, Living, and Leaving the White Evangelical Church. She's not alone in leaving the church. She's found she's among a rising generation fleeing the fold. That's April 25th at the Crawford in Pasadena. Tickets at laist.com/events.